I'm Malcolm Burnley, in for Marty Moskowain, and this is Radio Times. Home is where the heart is, but for a lot of us, home is also where the stuff is, and lots of it. We collect objects, pile them up, and form attachments. Often, they remind us of a lost loved one or a cherished memory. Grandma's ashtray, middle school writing samples, even that musty old button collection. Increasingly, though, people are feeling held captive by their stuff, as if they're wading endlessly through their own belongings or downright ignoring them out of fear. About 1 in 40 people worldwide is affected by hoarding disorder, according to the American Psychiatric Association. And a recent study says the pandemic has only heightened the stress and symptoms associated with clutter. When was the last time you ventured up to the attic, opened that junk drawer, or gave away those boxes of Legos? If the thought makes you overwhelmed, then we have the right conversation for you. Our guest is Matt Paxton, organizing expert, featured cleaner on A&E's Hoarders, and host of the Emmy-nominated PBS series Legacy List. He joins us to talk about the importance of decluttering and how telling stories about our stuff can be a way of preserving them forever. In his new book, he writes, quote, "The physical process of decluttering and downsizing is a lot of work, but the harder battle is fighting through the emotional and psychological barriers," end quote. Matt Paxton's new book is Keep the Memories, Lose the Stuff, Declutter, Downsize, and Move Forward with Your Life. Matt Paxton, welcome to Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. Really excited for this conversation, honestly. So you've made a career in business and on television, convincing other people to let go of their stuff. But your book begins with, I would say, a moment of doubt and somewhat of a role reversal during the pandemic, where you had to stare down a decision to downsize. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's really easy to give people advice. It's another to follow your own. I fell in love halfway through the pandemic and decided to move from my home of 15 years with my three sons. We moved to Atlanta, Georgia, because I decided to marry a minimalist. So not only did I have to go through my entire house, but I couldn't bring anything with me because we don't have any space. We live in a real small home. So yeah, it was a very hard decision because I had given this advice for 20 years. But when it's not your stuff, it's really easy to give advice. But when it's your stuff, that's when the emotions kick in.
For sure. And out of the stuff that you were having a really hard time separating from, is there one or two objects that really come to mind?
Well, it's categories, right? Like, it's the attic. I'll talk a lot about the attic and the garage because the attic is where you put stuff that you, and some of us have basements, but depending upon where you live, you have that space. Might be the guest bedroom, whatever it is, but you put all the stuff you're avoiding. And for me, it was, my dad had died. My grandparents had died. I had a failed marriage. I had a few failed businesses. Like all of those things, you have a little bit of stuff left over from. And they go into the attic because I'll deal with them later. And I was now sitting in later. And so it was hard. And it, because it's this, I tell everybody, it's not the stuff that you're attached to. It's the emotions attached to the stuff that you really have a hard time with. And so I had to relive, my dad had been dead for 20 years, but I had to relive all those things. I had to go through the guest list at the funeral, and I had to go through all of his old advertising things. And, just all these things that reminded me of my dad, who I loved a lot. And here I was 20 years later, now a father of three, re-going through all of my dad's stuff. The last time I put that stuff in a box, I was just a kid. And so it was really, really challenging because you're dealing with all of these emotions. And that's what everyone's going through in the U.S. right now. It may not be their dad's stuff, but it's something.
Yeah. And speaking with clients and then, I guess also speaking to your own experience, what about the pandemic do you think has really, exacerbated some of the stress around stuff and clutter and messy desks? What has it been about the pandemic?
Well, we're home now, right? And that's not going to change. I mean, I don't think any of us are going back to the same level of, busy 24/7. We're still busy, but we're doing different things, and we're home with our family now. We're spending more. We're seeing, I don't know the divorce rates, but I know they're much higher, right, post-pandemic. And it's because we're home and we're forced to deal with the real stuff. I also will argue, I think engagement rates are up, right? We're seeing people fall in love. And so what's happening is we're spending more time with our family, and I am seeing this across the board with my clients and with my viewers on TV. People are putting more emphasis on family than stuff. And that's important because, believe it or not, in my work, whether it be hoarding or helping seniors downsize, I've always seen people, they get too much stuff because they're actually trying to find happiness and self-worth and value out of their stuff. What the pandemic has taught us is there's more value in family and living than stuff.
Well, before we get more into your philosophy and some of the advice that you give and how to take yourself, I want to close the loop on the story that I asked you to share at the beginning. You know, a lot of people, as you said, have been struggling with all sorts of things during the pandemic. I gather it was a happy ending, though, with you and your now wife?
Yeah, we now have 7 kids. We've combined 2 families, and we are now living as a family of minimalists. And so, yeah, it's crazy what you'll do for love, you know, and as I found with all my clients and myself, all those worries and all those fears were over stuff. And when you now, a year later, I have a whole life here, I don't even remember what I was upset about. I don't even remember what stuff I struggled with, but I remember it was a big deal at the time.
I want to invite our audience to join the conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times, or you can call in 1-888-477-9499. We want to hear with you if you've been struggling with clutter. Have you felt weighed down by it? And is there an object that you just can't part ways with? So let's get in, Matt, let's get into some of the psychological impact, I guess, of having clutter, of seeing it. Whether it's what you hear from clients or, you know, what you've studied, what is that psychological impact? Why is it important to declutter our lives?
So a pile of anything is a pile of something you didn't get to. And so for a lot of my clients and people I know, it's just a pile of failures, right? I've heard it called everything from fixin' twos or I'm going to get to it or, you know, all types of things. But at the end of the day, a pile, it's a pile of stress. It's a large list of things I didn't get to. And so the bigger the piles, the more stress. And that can be physical or digital. Email is the same way. You open up your email and you see that you've got 6,000 unanswered emails. Well, then that creates stress, right? And so physical or digital, it just adds to the things you didn't get to. And so for many of us, I'm 47, for many of us that grew up post-1969, we have this view that we have to be perfect and we have to be successful and we have to be the best at everything. And when you see these piles, it means you weren't the best and you're further and further away each day from being the best. And that seems kind of daunting, but what I'm saying is in a post-World War II society, we turned from family to stuff, right? And our value, you know, we went out to get, you know, we got back from the war, GI Bill, bought a home, and then you had to fill the home, right? And that's how the suburbs were created. And so that was our grandparents, and then our parents, and now we're the third generation of consumers. And the fourth generation, the millennials, they're really the ones protesting it. They're saying, nah, man, I'm not going to work 10, 15 hours a day to buy a bunch of junk that I don't need. I'm going to find happiness outside of the workplace and outside of stuff. And so we're seeing a fourth generation cycle, which is really cool. But all four generations have struggled with, is it stuff or is it experiences that bring me joy? And what we're seeing now again is we're coming back around to is experiences that are more positive than stuff.
So just kind of defining the issue again, that was really interesting, and I want to circle back to that. But just defining the issue about why people collect things and more specifically, why people hoard, you know, why people collect things that they might not need.
Okay, so let's start with hoarding. Yeah, let's start with hoarding, and then we'll go to collect.
Yeah, hoarding. How do you define hoarding?
Okay, so hoarding is actually an obsessive desire to acquire a significant amount of things. That's the textbook definition. Now, what's actually happening there is people are looking for their happiness and self-worth in stuff because of trauma. Something bad has happened to the hoarder. I've cleaned thousands of hoarders' homes. I've done it professionally for 20 years. I've been on TV for 13. And I've cleaned the worst houses in the country. 100% every time, something bad happened to them. And they were looking to find a better life in stuff. Just like you might have a friend that looks for it in exercise or alcohol or drugs or work or even faith, okay? And those are all positive and negative things I've lumped together in one time. That's on purpose because people look for their self-worth and their positivity somewhere. For our hoarders, it happens to be stuff.
Mm. And you write a lot about, and you just said this, how hoarding is a way to cover up pain, right? And yep. It sounds like some of that can be fear of losing a former self, or, you know, maybe the memories of the greatest time in their life as people think of it that way, right?
Yep.
Or
yeah,
a loved one.
Yeah. On the hoarding side, it usually was either divorce or death, to be really blunt, and most or abuse. Abuse is the third one, physical, sexual, or emotional. All of them are loss. You've lost something, and so you want something better. On the hoarding side, I mean, it can get really, really emotional, but a lot of times they're actually protecting themselves from the outside world because the stuff, they're actually walls of stuff, like physical walls of stuff in their house. And the reason is, their trauma is so big, their hurt is so big, that they collect stuff because the stuff won't hurt them, right? People will. And so they actually create a wall between the real world and inside their home, and they feel safer than what happened to them. And so what I always have to tell people is the bigger the pile, the bigger the mess, you have to understand the bigger the hurt, the bigger the trauma.
So we have a comment from Mike. He says, I think our guest is being too negative about clutter, calling it all stuff. He says, I love my garage full of junk and I collect antique bottles. I don't see any of it as just stuff. I'm sure this is an opinion you come across a lot. What would, I guess, would be your rebuttal to Mike, or how would you guide him towards decluttering?
First of all, yeah, Mike's got a good point, right? Is all stuff negative? No. The difference between collecting and hoarding is, you know, hoarding actually causes your family or your home or yourself damage, right? You've got so much that it actually causes physical structural damage to your family or your friends or your safety. If you just happen to have, he said he likes bottles. He likes really cool antique bottles, and that's something he enjoys. He spends his time doing it. He enjoys collecting. He enjoys, inventorying and then sharing with people. That's the kicker for me right there, the sharing. Hmm. If he's actually able to have a life inside and outside of his home with this stuff, then that's great. Where it crosses over into negativity is, and this is where a lot of my clients are, they have so much stuff they're collecting that they can't get home health care in to take care of their partner, right? They got so many piles in the hallway that they can't get a wheelchair in, or they can't get a stretcher in from an ambulance. Wow. That's when it crosses the line and becomes hoarding. Mike's house is probably fine. And he's got neighbors that come over, and he's got friends, and he gets to share his collection, and he has a really good life. That's awesome. There's nothing. In fact, I salute that. I personally am a minimalist. I would say it's not for most people.
Right.
I am a minimalist because of survival. I have 7 kids. If I let all my kids have a lot of stuff, then I'll be broke and I'll have no space in my house.
We're going to hold that thought, Matt. We're going to go on a short break and come back. We're talking with Matt Paxton, featured cleaner on A&E's Hoarders and author of a new book. We'll be back on Radio Times in just a minute.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Malcolm Burnley. This is Radio Times. We're here with Matt Paxton, whose new book is Keep the Memories, Lose the Stuff, Declutter, Downsize, and Move Forward with Your Life. Matt, I cut you off briefly before break, but you were making the point about, I guess, the difference between a healthy relationship with a collection or a garage full of stuff and hoarding. Did you want to finish that point?
Well, yeah, it's important. I think this is going to support what Mike said as well here, the viewer or the listener. 5% of the country struggles with hoarding. That's about 15 million. 95% of the people just have a little more stuff than they actually want. And so we talk about hoarding a lot because it's really the foundation of understanding stuff, but it doesn't affect the majority of us. Right? The most of us just have a little more stuff than we want, and we have collections that we can live with.
So one of the, I guess, biggest pieces of advice or your philosophy is what you call a legacy list, which is asking people to ask themselves, what are the items that will help me live happily and keep my story living on forever, is what you write. You know, a short list of items that you really can't live without. I really enjoyed the story that you had about the first item you put on your own legacy list, which was the golden ring or rings of your father. Could you share that story? And then I guess as a way of introducing this idea of the legacy list.
Yes, I love the story. So, you know, my dad was in advertising, so we were broke and we were rich many times over, right? And that's just how advertising is. And if you had a family member who's in it, you understand. And we were on one of the more downsides of that. And my dad was broke. He had sold his house. He was trying to sell his car. He had moved into an apartment to live closer to my brother and I. We're at my mom's house. And it was just a downswing, right? And he somehow convinced Tiffany's, the jeweler Tiffany's, to get him to make their catalog that year. And he pulled it off. I mean, he was a very good ad man, and he created the whole set inside his apartment. He had a photographer buddy come in and do it and traded in a lot of favors and made a really good. He wrote the copy himself, he produced it, he made a wonderful catalog. And it finally was time to get paid, right? It was he had done it. He fixed the problem. But he found one of the rings that he shot in one of the pictures. He really liked it. And so when it was time to get his check, he goes, "Hey, how about we just do a wash? I'll keep the ring and you guys don't pay me."
Not the financially smart decision, but it says a lot about your dad.
Horrible decision, right? Horrible decision financially. But that was my dad. That's why he was in advertising. And the night he died, he gave me that ring, believe it or not. And I still have that ring today. And I love it. And I love that ring because it does two things. One, it just reminds me of my dad, exactly the crazy wild man that he was. It also reminds me as an entrepreneur 20 years later to always get paid.
Yeah. Yes.
And so I wear that ring every day. I tell that story probably once a week. My children, I have six boys, one girl. My six boys will wear that ring when they get married, right? We'll always carry that ring with us. And that was one of the original legacy list items. And what a legacy list is, a legacy list is obviously the name of my TV show on PBS. It's called Legacy List with Matt Paxton. But what it is it's a list of five or six items that really tell your family story. And they're the foundation of the stuff you're going to keep. And it's one of the first things I want people to do. I want them to make that list first for two reasons. One, I know that we keep stuff because of the people we love. That's why you don't hang on to it because of it. It's just atoms, right? It's just matter. You hang on to it because of the emotional stories attached to it. But what setting that legacy list does is that you actually end up telling five or six great stories, right? And when you share those items and you share those stories, you start to tell your family history. And where it really pays off is when you're in the back of the closet or you're in the attic or you're in the garage and you've already established what's most important from those four or five people or the four or five items in your family. So when you're going through that 10th box in the attic, you're less likely to hold on to the things that don't actually matter because you've already created your legacy list.
So I want to get into some of the other, you know, really, I was impressed with the amount of nuts and bolts kind of takeaways and piece of advice. And for example, your 1 month rule, which I want to get into in a minute, but it seems like really the crux of the book is about storytelling, as you're saying. And, you know, a lot of listeners may have heard of Marie Kondo and, you know, that philosophy about, does this object bring me joy or spark joy, I believe is the exact phrase. Yes. And you distilled, your philosophy is a little bit different. Is it fundamentally about storytelling, or could you define kind of, if you had to distill your own decluttering philosophy?
Yeah, so I mean, and you're right. Like Marie Kondo's is spark joy. And as my dad always said, there's 100 ways to drive to California. Okay, everybody here, we want to have less stuff. We want to have more happiness, a better life with less stuff. And so if Marie Kondo's method works, awesome. If mine works, that's great too. We just want to find different ways to do it. For me, I have found sparking, you know, for a hoarder or for seniors, which are my two main audiences that I work with on it and have for the last 20 plus years, everything sparks joy. So that method didn't work for us. We wouldn't have a hoarded house if it didn't all spark joy. And so I had to go a little deeper, you know. I had to get a little deeper and understand what was going on. And I learned it just over my 20 years in these houses. And it was, at the end of the day, it was, man, they loved somebody. They really loved someone, and that's why they held on to that item. And so I just, you know, for 10 years I helped people clean out their houses before I realized, man, we were just visiting. We were like in the living room, but we were kind of just telling stories on the front porch, you know, and they would tell me the stories, and then we would be able to get rid of a few of the items and keep some others. And so my method was very slowly created over 20 years, which was really just get those emotional stories out, celebrate the person that they're attached to, and really prioritize the ones that matter most. And that allows you to let go of others.
And this, in a way, then it allows, it sounds like the stories to live on, or that's part of the legacy living on, even without the object, if you're able to hang on to, I know there's a little bit in the background, but if you're able to hang on to, no, don't worry about it, if you're able to hang on to the stories and retell them, right? That's kind of a form maybe of keeping the memories alive?
Yeah, so a lot of people will say, hey, we'll take pictures of it, and they want you to digitize the memory, and that is a great solution for some things. But if you have 10,000 pictures on your phone, are you really prioritizing the item, right? Mm-hmm. A digital pile is still a pile, and it still creates stress. And so what I've really, really honed in on is, hey, tell these stories, share these stories, keep the memories alive. I mean, there's people today that will tell that story about my dad. They'll think that's crazy and that's hilarious, but they'll be talking about my dad, right? And that keeps my dad living forever. One thing we didn't expect on our show Legacy List on PBS, just being on television and these families telling their story, it actually kept their family members' legacy alive, even though the people had passed away. And the family members were able all of a sudden to start letting go of stuff because they were sharing these stories on TV. And they were like, well, gosh, I don't need it now. Everyone knows about my dad. Right? So, I mean, is this method going to work for everybody? Of course not. No method works for everyone. But there are people that just flat out need to prioritize the stories because they have too many items to tell.
I want to bring in a few more of our listeners. We got an email from Gina, and she says, I'm 59, my husband is 62, and we live in our original four-bedroom house. I feel like the stuff we have is suffocating and holding us back from being free in our empty nest and still healthy years, but my husband and I have different thresholds of tolerance. How do we work together? Do you have any advice?
Yeah, well, welcome to marriage, first of all, right? And I remind everybody, you've been married, sounds like 30 plus years. So, right, like it's annoying, but it's not like a deal breaker, right? And so she's doing this at the right time. You've been in the house for 30 some years. You don't have any health issues that are currently going to hold you back. But I can warn all listeners, most people call me because something has forced them to clean out, whether it be health or a loss of life, or they got to sell their house sometimes. I mean, we're in a great housing market, so a lot of people have decided, hey, I wasn't even thinking about moving, but now I'm going to move, and I need to do it in a week because I got $150,000 more than I was offered, right? Those are different, difficult times. You want to do it now when you have the chance. And so what I really encourage families like her is actually both of you go create your own legacy list. Pick five items that mean the most to you. Like if your house burned down, what are the five items you had to have? Right? And write them down and write the stories. And then my real challenge to people is to start small. Most people, they've been in the house 30 years and they, you know, it took them 35 years to create this pile of stuff. And then they think, oh, well, we'll knock it out in a long holiday weekend, right? The kids will come home for Thanksgiving and we'll knock it out on Friday and Saturday. Well, if it took you 30 to 35 years to fill it, you're not going to do it in 2 days. And so that quitting is the biggest challenge of decluttering. Believe it or not, quitting is what always slows people down. And the biggest mistake is you try to take on too much. So I tell everybody, clean for 10 minutes a night. That's it. Called 10-minute sweep. Start really small, quick, a very small area. I always say like the junk drawer or the junk mail that's on your dining room table or like half a bookshelf or, you know, even your dresser drawer next to your bed, the bedstand. Something really small, and you just start to sort through it 10 minutes a night. If you do that every night for 2 weeks, you get in the habit, and then you can increase that to 25 minutes, 30 minutes. It's really not about what you accomplish. It's that you get used to accomplishing something. But take your time and take it slow.
Your book's jam-packed full of so many tangible takeaways. For example, when you're cleaning out, you talk about how you're going to find loose change, you're probably going to find some dollar bills, and recommend that people have a fishbowl, specifically a fishbowl, to put the coins in because it makes this wonderful sound and kind of keeps the motivation going. Another piece of advice you have is the one-month rule. Could you tell us what that is?
Yeah, so one-month rule is not a particularly appreciated rule that I have. I say if you haven't used the item in 1 month, you should donate it or sell it. And people get really upset with me, and then they argue. And every time I do a speech on this, or every time I present this book, someone argues with me on this number. And I say success. That's the point. I picked a number that was absolutely not realistic, right? But then the person tells me what the number should be. If I told you 6 months, you would ignore it. You wouldn't even think about it. You wouldn't discuss it. But I put a very unrealistic number on purpose. It was a trick, and my editors don't like it, but I'm really still proud that we did it this way, because what it does is it forces you to decide what that number is. I know it's not 1 month, but you tell me what it is. If it's a year, it's too long. I will argue that. If you haven't used the item, I don't know. We're in Pennsylvania. Like, let's put an asterisk next to skis, right? Like, we'll put an asterisk next to a couple seasonal things. a Steelers jersey. Occasionally they're going to win, right? So you can keep that more than 1 year. All right?
You know your audience here.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I know my audience. Yes, right? I didn't say Eagles.
Yeah, it's very smart.
Steelers. Yeah. So, you know, like, there are things you want to keep, right? But for the most part, we can get rid of it, I think, in under 6 months. But I want you to make that decision on what that number really is, and I want you to stick to it.
This is Radio Times. I'm Malcolm Burnley, filling in for Marty Moskowain. You're listening to Radio Times from WHYY in Philadelphia. So, Matt, let's get to another piece of advice, or maybe I shouldn't say advice, but practice that you recommend, which is upcycling. For those who don't know, could you define what upcycling is, and also how, you know, you recommend clients maybe could turn something on their legacy list into something more practical?
Yeah, so upcycling is taking something old and then creating a new object out of it that will be useful in your life, and then it continues the legacy of your family living on. Again, I'm 47, so everyone my age, we received a blanket made out of t-shirts from when we were in high school and college, right? And many of us have these blankets that an aunt went and took all of our t-shirts and made them into an awesome blanket. That's upcycling. I've seen one cool thing in my family, in my career, is I get to see families get really creative and make really cool things out of objects they no longer need. Your grandma's china is probably the most creative thing I've seen done in the last 10 years. I've seen people take grandma's china and bash it all up and create pottery out of it, a new modern bowl. And then everyone gets a piece of that, right? So now everyone shares it. The goal is to keep the memory living in an item that is now useful that wasn't once.
We have a comment from Becky. She says, I lost my husband. I'm struggling to say goodbye to his belongings. To say goodbye to these things is too hard. First of all, Becky, I'm sorry for your loss. One thing that you recommend in the book is possibly to record some of these memories or stories as well, so that in addition to telling them, you know, there's some level of preservation. How do you recommend people go about doing that? Do they invite a friend over to talk about them, a relative? How should they kind of capture some of these stories?
All right. So Becky's situation is really unique. Becky, hang on. Don't leave, because this is your topic is very timely, and I want to hit more on it. But for the most part, I want people to get a friend there. It's not always your best friend. It's not always your mom, right? It might be someone that's maybe less personal to you. It's someone that likes being with you and is interested in your stories. And a lot of listeners will think, well, I don't have anybody. I'm alone. And I'll say, that's not true. You don't have a partner anymore. You might, you know, your partner might have passed away. But there are people that want to help. Neighbors offer all the time, people from church. There's people around your world that want to help you. This is the time to do it. Have people come in for an hour and literally help you. Just have them hold a bag or hold your cell phone while you tell the story. I think it's important to digitize these memories. And the moment in time that you're going through it right now. That's really important. You know, Becky's dealing with some very emotional things, and that's part of the story. So waiting 5 years to tell this story may not be the right thing for her. Telling the story now is when it's most fresh and most real because of the emotions that are naturally there. Mm. Now I got to say this. I know I'm talking a lot.
No, go ahead.
You're going through a real situation right now. And at your age, your friends are going to want to make you clean it up faster than you need to. All right. To remember the reviewers, Becky's husband's passed away and she's not ready to go through it. And guess what? That's okay. You don't have to, unless you financially must, take your time and do it at your pace. And the reason your friends want you to do it is because they want you to move on. They want you to start dating, right? And that's ridiculous. You're going to be ready when you're ready, and you're going to know when you're ready. And all you know right now is that you're not ready to go through it, and that's okay. But someday you will know. I've had a lot of clients going through exactly what she's going through. And I'm just telling you, take your time because you will know when it's time to go through it.
That's great. About another minute before we come up on another short break. Do you have general expectations for every client or is it individual regarding how much they should declutter? Like what should be a general goal or a ballpark that people should go for? 20%, 50%? What would you say?
I say 50% for most. Some of us will go to 75%. Some of us will aim for 50, and some of us want to run a marathon, and we only run a 5K. Is that still successful? Yes, you did something, right? So I like to say set a goal of 50. If you only hit 25, that's okay. You still got rid of some stuff.
Okay. And one other just short question about, I mean, how do people – maybe we'll return to this after break, but just to get us started, how do we continue to not acquire more stuff? It seems like, you know, purging could be one thing, but then people could easily acquire more. So if you have just a quick, maybe 15 seconds and we'll return back.
Oh, I have the perfect answer for that, but they're going to have to come back after the break.
Okay. Well, we're with Matt Paxton, who's a featured cleaner on A&E's Hoarders, along with PBS's Legacy List with Matt Paxton. I'm Malcolm Burnley, in for Marty Moskowain. This is Radio Times. We'll be back after a short break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Malcolm Burnley. This is Radio Times. We're here with PBS's Legacy List. Sorry, we're here with the host of PBS Legacy List with Matt Paxton, who is Matt Paxton. Matt, you write in your book that storage is a $40 billion industry in the U.S. And before break, I posed the question of, you know, not only how do we get rid of stuff, how can we keep stuff out, right? What are your thoughts or recommendations for people to kind of keep the practice going after the cleanup?
All right, so you did a lot of work to get your house back in order, and you want to keep it that way. I got a bunch of rules. One is equal in, equal out. All right, every time you've got the house set up the way you want it, if you bring in a new pair of pants, then you need to donate an old pair of pants. All right, you bring in a new pair of shoes, you can donate an old pair of shoes. Equal in, equal out is number one. Number two is every item has a home. Right? Every item has a home in your home, and you need to take it immediately there. I think the biggest challenge I saw, specifically with my hoarders, and even myself now at 47, I'm starting to do this. I'll go to the store, and then I'll either leave the bags in the car, or I just put them down when I walk in the door, and then I don't put the items away. You got to put the items away immediately. Take everything out of the bag. So that's another rule. Take everything out of the bag and put it in its place. If it doesn't have a place, do you really need it? All right. Or you got to go back to equal in, equal out. Another very unpopular rule of having to keep your house clean is to have a budget and financial budget and actually look at where you spend your money each month. And believe it or not, if you're looking at your money on a financial budget, you will pretty much find about $500 a month of stuff you don't need to buy anymore. Mm-hmm. And that excess stuff is often what keeps the house full.
So one thing I wanted to bring up was that, you know, there are other people who swear by keeping their stuff. And, you know, there have been some social science research around cluttering and its connection with creative thinking. And maybe actually there's a positive correlation there. I remember reading a book about creativity a few years ago and really clung to the fact that my desk was so messy, right? And was like, oh, no, here it is in the book. It says that, you know, there's actually some upside to being cluttered or being, you know, having a lot of clutter on your desk. What do you say to the folks who try to, I guess, find a way or a logical end around to actually cleaning it up?
So if it's not affecting you or your children or your partner negatively, then who cares? Do what you want, right? Some people are just messy, and that's okay. They may not be the person I'm going to hang out with every day, but you don't have to be perfect. And I don't think this, you know, am I a minimalist? Yes. Do I suggest it to most? Actually, no. I think the principles of having more life with less stuff is real. But you got to find your happy medium. Same thing with weight loss, right? Like, I'm always like, well, I feel great in my skin. I got 30 extra pounds, you know, and I tell everybody how great I am until I lose it, right? And then I feel even better. if it bothers you, then it matters to you, right? If it bothers you, then fine. I think the biggest challenge is, just like one of the earlier callers, almost every time one partner is not fine with it, another partner is. Right? Yeah. And so you got to find that happy medium. But I will say this. I hate to support this, but it's true. If I go back to my thousands of hoarders are brilliant. They're incredibly intelligent. They were always highly successful and very caring individuals. Most of my hoarders, the stuff that they saved was actually to give away to other people. It was almost rarely for themselves, or it was for artwork. So I think the studies you're saying are probably true, but you got to find the happy medium that works for you and the people in your life.
Yeah, and your partner. I know I can definitely relate to that. That, you know, regardless of how I feel about it, right? Who I'm living with might not feel the same way.
You know, I can say this: there was a point in my move last year where I almost decided not to move because I, the guy from Hoarders, the guy from Legacy List, didn't want to let go of all of this stuff. And I was really struggling. And my fiance said to me, okay, I'm here. You can live in this house with me with less stuff, or you can stay there and be really happy alone with all your things.
Yeah, when you put it like that.
She put it pretty simply. And now she's a hardcore minimalist. And I'll say this, I'm really happy.
Yeah.
And I don't remember what I missed.
Let's talk about photos. Photos are sometimes the hardest thing for people to get rid of because of everything we've already outlined and talked about, but there's so much sentimental value built up in them. Do you treat photos any differently? Do you recommend that people treat photos any differently than you know, other objects in their house? And how do you streamline photo collections?
Yeah, I hate photos, man. It's the worst, all right? Because there's so many of them and they all have memories. At least we think. And it's the thing that we put off the most. So I actually will argue two things now. Either start with your photos or finish with your photos. I actually hired a professional photo organizer, believe it or not, to help me. Like, I struggle with photos.
There's a whole industry, you know, which I found out in your book around this.
It's crazy, right? There's thousands of people that what they do is help you manage your digitized photos and your offline photos. And I've hired a professional, and they actually have my email now as well. But you know, I'll say this: trim them down first, right? A stack of pictures, 1 inch thick, is 100 pictures. So now you're doing the math in your head. Oh my God, I have 100,000 pictures, right? If you have 20 shoeboxes full of pictures, that's too many. Right? And so I tell people that the goal should be to get down to 2 to 3 shoeboxes. That should be the goal. And the best way to do that at the beginning, I have 4 things I say get rid of. Get rid of your duplicates right away. Right? We all have duplicates from the 80s and 90s from People's Drug, which is now CVS, from Fox Photo, from 1 Hour Photo. All these places gave us duplicates. Just very quickly go through and throw away the duplicates. Right? Throw away your generic landscapes, which means it's a beach or a mountain. It's just I don't know what mountain it is. I don't even know what beach it is. There's no one in the picture. Get rid of those. Get rid of your negatives. This is an unpopular one, but you haven't used them yet. You're not going to use them now. Right? You're 60, right? You never use the negatives. Get rid of those. So get rid of the duplicates, the negatives, the generic landscapes. And except for the really old, like generic, you know, if you've got really old, like 10 types or things that are for genealogy, I would say hold on to those. But for the most part, get rid of the pictures that you don't remember the name of anyone in the picture, or even worse, you don't like anyone in the picture. Right? And these are the ones like from college, right? Like, oh yeah, I remember that person. Don't remember her name, right? And I don't really care. You're allowed to throw those away. Or from a first marriage that was 40 years ago. You don't have an obligation to hold on to those. If you do those four topics right there, I guarantee you, you'll lose half the pictures right away. And you can do that really quick. You do that 10 minutes a night, you can knock that out in about 3 weeks. And it's not overwhelming. And you get a couple good laughs out of there too. And then it becomes a pile that you now can really start to prioritize.
So we have an email from Betsy that speaks to something I've been meaning to ask, which is, she says, I'm the last person in my family of birth. So I inherited a house filled with memories and too much stuff. So many books, games, projects. It has been a huge undertaking to go through all of it. I went through so many papers that said, save these papers. She continues, but the point is about inheriting stuff, I guess, from family members or people you care about who instructed you to save them and getting over that. Do you have tips about getting over a sense of guilt or maybe responsibility?
Yeah. So responsibility is one thing. Obligation is another. And guilt is attached to all of them. If you are over 50, you have guilt and you feel like you have an obligation to save everything, including furniture that you hated when you were a kid and you hate it now. Right? If you are under 50, I assure you, you do not care. You don't even know what I'm talking about on this guilt thing. It tends to be, the other issue is, over 50, it was always the oldest adult daughter who was tasked with this. Okay? Under 50, that's changed a little bit, but it's primarily still the oldest adult daughter. And so, yeah, they're getting two or three estates at the same time, and they are feeling overwhelmed because it is an enormous amount of work, and they're feeling guilty. I'm going to say this. It's in the book. People get either they really embrace it or they get upset with it, but I'm fine either way with this. You do not have to keep something your great aunt gave you 50 years ago because she's dead and she's probably going to be okay with it.
Right. Would she want you to have or feel guilt or burdened by it?
I promise you she'd rather you have a happier life now. And by the way, you're probably the age she was when she passed. Right. And people don't understand. Like, I think about that. Like, I am my grandmother. When I was a kid and I have all these great memories of my grandma, she's the age I am now. Right. And I thought she was an old lady back then. You don't have to keep everything. Once someone gives it to you, it is yours and you can do what you want with it. I think ways to get around that is donate it to groups that would appreciate it as much as that loved one did. Okay. Donation is a really important tool in all the things that I do. If it's sellable, if it's actually worth a lot of money, sell it and then give that money to a group that would benefit that person would care about. Do something with it that would bring joy to that person that gave it to you. That should check off your guilt box. But you do not have a legal or financial obligation to keep it going. The person would rather you have a better life than to just become a library for their things. And I'm going to speak to books, and I understand I'm on NPR. This is not a popular statement.
We have a question from Ruth that just says, why do people hoard books?
Oh, man, books are a moment in time, right? Books are so personal. Books are something that, I was really lucky with my dad. When my dad died, he had a really big bookshelf, and he would fancy himself a librarian. And I actually had a guy that worked for me one time. This guy had spent 20 years in prison. Right? He was a cleaner for me. And a little lady was like, well, this is like my little library. And he goes, oh, great. Where did you get your library sciences degree?
Wow.
She goes, excuse me? And he goes, you ain't no librarian. Stop making your house a library. And she and I just looked at each other and we started laughing. And we're like, he's right. Okay. We keep books because they really brought us a lot of joy and a lot of happiness at a point in our life. So I actually think books are like trophies. They're basically a trophy for a moment in time. I encourage people to pass those books on, donate them, get them out to people that can really enjoy them better, or give them to people that you think need them. But get them out of your house. You're actually doing the least amount of service for it by keeping it in your house. And they're the most expensive to hold on to because people have to pick them up and move them. That being said, if the person's over 75, shake every single book because I've found thousands of dollars in books.
On that note, I thought it would be fun. I don't want to give away everything that's in your book, but what one fun thing that you had a list of the top, I believe, 10 places most likely to find money in a home. What was the number one? This astonished me. The number one place where you might find hidden money.
Well, freezer, and then I think the first one I listed was the top of the toilet bowl.
That's right, top of the toilet bowl.
They'll put it in a Ziploc bag or an old ball glass jar, and they'll put it in the upper decker part of the toilet.
It always reminds me of, I believe in the first Godfather, they hide a weapon behind the toilet bowl, and so always check, I guess. I mean, you never know what you're going to find there.
Oh, man, we found, man, that's the coolest thing in my job. I find so much cool stuff. I had one guy, we found $2 million in stock certificates. They were old stock certificates with the CUSIP numbers that had not been converted to digital. And it was in an envelope that said trash, and it was sealed. Right, it was a big manila envelope, and it was sealed, and it said trash. And I was like, man, this guy wouldn't seal trash. There's going to be something open it up. $2 million in stock, man.
Wow.
Right? You never know what you're going to find, and I just love it. And I'm not saying that people listening are going to go find $2 million in their house, but you'll find something either financially or something emotionally valuable, and that's why it's worth going through all these houses and taking the time. Mm.
You're listening to Radio Times from WHYY in Philadelphia. Based on the book, I know you've seen it all and you've been asked to go on a number of treasure hunts and interesting, you know, finding interesting objects in homes. You tell a great story of finding these old train plates in a client's home that ended up being worth tens of thousands of dollars. Do you have a list? I'm sure there's a long list, but what's one very strange request, I guess, you've gotten from a client, either to help them clean something out that was very odd or to find something that was very strange? I'd love to. What's one thing that jumps to mind?
Yeah, it was like a brownstone on Central Park, and the bank hired us. Or the lawyers hired us, actually. They wouldn't tell us who owned the house. They just said, "Hey, you gotta find. There's a watch in this house, and once you find the watch, leave." And so me and my guys went in and cleaned, and it was we had to wear clear backpacks. We couldn't have any pockets in our outfits. Like, it was very, and we had a security guard at the front that would check everything coming in and out, which was, we didn't care. It was great. And we found the watch in like an hour, you know, and they'd paid us for a week. And they're like, if you find it or not, you just have to, you know, leave. And we found it within an hour, but it was about $1 million watch. And,
you ever find out like anything else about the watch or why it was so special?
I can't. Well, I can't say whose it was, but yeah, I mean, it was a very expensive watch. I can see now why they spent the money to find it. I'll tell you, this business, people are excited about the financial stories, but it's the emotional stories that are really, really cool. You know, like, I mean, gosh, we found one guy found out he had a brother and he never knew it. And he's like, I need you to find something. Right, about this brother that I just found. His dad had just died, and in the will it said, hey, we have a brother. He didn't know anything about it, and so the family was shocked. And so we had to find the box, right? The box that had all the communications with this child who's now in their 40s. And we found it, and it was really cool to be able to help him, you know, connect to his long-lost brother. Anything and everything, it's all there, and we find, you know, it's all in the home, and you just got to spend the time finding it.
Well, thanks so much. We'll have to leave it there. We didn't even get a chance to talk about your favorite Richmond Spiders, but that'll be for another time.
Let's talk about the first game, not the second.
I was just going to say, Matt Paxton, thanks so much for joining us. His new book is Keep the Memories, Lose the Stuff, Declutter, Downsize, and Move Forward with Your Life. Matt Paxton, thanks so much for being on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
The engineer for today's edition is Adam Staniszewski. The show is produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Malcolm Burnley, in for Marty Moskowain. Thank you for joining us.